I'd like to welcome you to the 352nd District Court. I want to welcome you to the Second Court of Appeals, and thank you for coming today to argue your case. We have one case that will be argued at 3 o'clock, and the attorneys have checked in. Before we begin, I need to introduce the panel to you. There has been a panel change. So to my left is Justice Lee Gabriel, and to my right is Justice Bill Meyer.
Good afternoon.
And I'm Chief Justice Bonnie Setterth. So welcome. Would the clerk please call the case?
The court will now call Aaron Emerson versus the state of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Adam L. Arrington will argue for the appellant. Mr. Matthew J. Witten will argue for the state.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case is a criminal mischief case. I don't think the facts giving rise to the criminal mischief charge are in dispute. Based on my reading of the state's brief, there is a factual dispute as to the testimony at trial. That goes to our fourth issue. We've raised a total of four issues. I'll get to that a little bit later, but unless the court would like me to go over the facts, I'll just get right into our argument. The leading argument on appeal, the issue we've raised, has to do with the defendant's right to an instruction on the lesser-included offense of Class A misdemeanor criminal mischief.
Would you tell me what the theory is the rational juror could embrace to get to the misdemeanor?
Certainly, Your Honor. While we don't challenge the sufficiency of the evidence to support the conviction on the greater-included offense, we do believe that because of the varying degree of corroboration, I'll call it, for Mr. Muller, Mr. Hamilton's testimony. Mr. Muller is the operator of the car wash. Mr. Hamilton, the owner, because of the varying quantum of evidence corroborating his testimony, we think it would have been rational for a jury to have a reasonable doubt as to the actual amount of pecuniary loss, because only some of his testimony, though he did testify to the amount of damages, the amount of loss being in excess of $9,000, was supported by proof of payment in the form of canceled checks. So this really comes down to the simple principle that just because evidence meets the legal minimum for proof beyond a reasonable doubt, or for a rational juror to be able to find all the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt, doesn't mean that a rational juror could not require in his or her own mind a greater level of proof, more than the bare legal minimum, to satisfy his or her own burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, so long that the juror follows the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And again, while there was certainly substantial evidence in this case, a juror may rationally have doubted the actual amount of pecuniary loss.
Well, then the juror could have found him not guilty.
Right. But again, just because the jury came back guilty on the greater included doesn't mean he wasn't entitled to an instruction on the lesser included.
Well, doesn't there have to be some evidence that if the defendant's guilty, he's only guilty of the lesser included offense?
Yes.
So other than your argument of corroboration, what evidence do you have that he's guilty only of the lesser included offense?
It's basically just the doubt as to the amount of pecuniary loss, because while, again, we don't dispute the invoices, although we challenge their admissibility in a separate issue. We know you're to consider all evidence both admissible and inadmissible. The jury could have said, well, I believe beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant caused this damage, that he ripped that machine out of the wall and it caused this hole. But I'm not convinced just based on Mr. Hamilton's testimony alone that the damages exceeded $2,500, but he did provide proof of payment in the form of those canceled checks totaling just under $2,500. Now the $400 check seems to be agreed, the state as much as conceded at trial, that most of that is for lost profits. So in fact, I think the state even told the jury take that out when calculating the amount of damages.
So are you saying that the jury could have just believed what they had documentation for?
Yes, and that would have been rational. A jury can disbelieve a witness's testimony, especially in light of the conflict between his and Mr. Mueller's testimony. And this is a point, I think that this is the one factual dispute as far as the testimony adduced at trial between us and the state. And it does go to both the first and the fourth issue we've raised. But we think that the jury argument that the state objected to and the court sustained that objection was a proper summation of the evidence or reasonable deduction from the evidence, because there was a conflict between the testimony of Mr. Mueller and Mr. Hamilton as far as what electrical work needed to be done, what had to be replaced. Now, the state seems to, if I understand my colleague's brief, seems to hang his hat on the fact that Mr. Mueller and Mr. Hamilton were asked about different photographs. However, the state even acknowledges in its brief that these photographs are of the same wall, just from different sides. One photograph is the inside of the wall, the other is of the outside. And the defense asked Mr. Hamilton who testified first, and asked Mr. Mueller about the conduit and the electrical equipment on the inside of the wall, and was asked, all of this is the original conduit that was in the room prior to the damage. Is that correct? He said, correct. And this electrical box is the same electrical box that was there prior to the damage. Is that correct? He said, yes. Earlier, Mr. Hamilton had testified when asked that all of the electrical conduit had to be replaced and repaired. He responded, on the inside. So that would be on the inside, the defense exhibit one, that photograph, same photograph that Mr. Mueller was later asked about. Some of it had to be replaced. Most of it had to be repaired and replaced. And all of the conduit on the outside was replaced. And then when asked, there was additional electrical work that had to be done for the conduit and everything that was on the backside of the wall. So again, we're talking about the inside of the wall. He said yes. So we do think there was a conflict between the testimony of Mr. Mueller and Mr. Hamilton. And this gets back to what would have been rational for a jury to find. I recently heard a phrase that I don't think I'd seen since law school, falsus in uno, falsus in omnibus. False in one thing, false in everything. The argument that if a jury finds that a witness was not telling the truth about one thing, then it can believe that the witness was not being truthful about anything. So we think it was rational, especially given the conflict between the testimony of Mr. Mueller and Mr. Hamilton, albeit on that one factual matter, for a jury to not be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt based on Mr. Hamilton's testimony alone. I want to touch briefly also on the admissibility of the business records, because although we find our second and third issues, I think, are pretty adequately briefed, I want to stress that Mr. Hamilton was not a qualified witness in the sense that he did not have personal knowledge of how the records, other than the receipt from Chapman's Welding Service, were prepared. And so it is true that the state and us don't dispute that he doesn't have to be the actual custodian of records or even be employed by the business that created the records, but he does have to have personal knowledge of the manner in which the records were prepared.
Well, even if these documents were erroneously admitted, the insurance proceeds alone would be sufficient to prove up the damages under the law. And so wouldn't this be harmless error anyway?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because I don't recall seeing anywhere in the record where documentation of the insurance proceeds, a check from the insurance company or anything, was actually offered in evidence. I believe Mr. Hamilton testified about that, but
you have to have the document? Can he testify? And if he testifies without objection, isn't that sufficient to prove up the amount of damages?
Well, but again, just because there was sufficient evidence to support a finding of guilt does not necessarily mean that that it was harmless. Again, it gets back to what likely swayed the jury. What weight did the jury attach to a particular piece of evidence? And typically, hard actual records, documentation, is more convincing than a testimony of a witness. Unless there are no further questions, I'll just basically take a seat and save the rest, get back to y'all in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I don't want to belabor everything that's in my brief, so I'll try to be quick. I think the main question, though, to ask is one that I have written in my brief, was, is there any set of facts a rational jury could have concluded that if he was guilty, then he was only guilty of a lesser-included offense? And under the Wortham case, there has to be some sort of affirmative evidence for the jury to make that finding. They could have brought a contractor to say, look at the pictures and say, you know, I could have done this for $1,000, that this guy got way overcharged. Something that a jury could have hung their hat on. And if you follow the appellant's argument to its logical conclusion, you almost have to reach a conclusion that more evidence is bad, that more evidence would lead to confusion. Because as you've noted, Chief Justice Sutter, there was testimony of a $12,000 insurance payout that would have been sufficient on its own. And a juror does not go into a case like this, or any case for that matter, in a vacuum. A juror is going to bring their own experiences, their own life into that jury room and see the photographs of the damage, hear the testimony in totality, and rationally reach a conclusion that the damage here had to have been greater than $2,500. The extra evidence that was brought in was to lock the case down, really, from the state's perspective. You asked the question, well, and again, there's no competing evidence to any of that. There's no affirmative evidence. There's no non-speculative evidence other than questioning, well, the jury could have believed this or disbelieved this. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. It's not our position that a juror, in any case, can't weigh some evidence in one way and weigh some evidence the other way. That's a juror's job. But here, no rational juror could have cherry-picked this evidence and ever reached a conclusion that the damage was less than $2,500. Let's take...
What about the documents? Could they have said... We only believe what the bills that they produced, produced canceled checks, and that's the believable evidence, and the rest isn't. And actually, that comes in just under $2,500. If you take out the $400 lost profits.
Right, I think it comes out to $2,496.
Exactly, it's very close. is that affirmative proof?
That's affirmative proof, but if that's what a jury had found, they could have just found him not guilty, because they would have added up to less than $2,500, and the way they were charged, they would have found him not guilty in that case. So I don't think getting into that speculative realm is helpful. And if you take the that kind of reasoning, if we go with that line of reasoning, you would have to almost hold, I think, that a lesser included instruction would be required in any criminal mischief or theft kind of case, down to the last penny, that we would have to charge every single case down from felony all the way to Class C in order to be in compliance with the lesser included rules. But that's just not what we have here. What the Wortham standard is there some kind of affirmative evidence to, like I said, bring a contractor in to say, oh, I could have done this for a lot cheaper? That's something a juror could have heard and said, well, I'm not sure this reaches $2,500. With respect to the photograph issue on the jury argument, the fourth issue, I do want to just mention, I think we do have a little bit of a factual dispute there, but it really needs to be noted two things, I would say. First of all, most of the damage was to the outside. There was, I believe, some testimony that the damage went all the way to the electrical pole out there. There was an extensive amount of electrical damage that had to be repaired, and if you also look at those photographs, the wall was basically destroyed. So regardless of what we're looking at, I believe that the court was correct in sustaining the state's objection to that line of argument, because it made the line of argument seem to make it seem that there was no electrical damage. And that was outside the record, or outside the state of the evidence. And even if, just do want to point out, even if we did discount all of the electrical work that was done, we would still be well above the $2,500 amount. I don't remember the Latin phrase that Senator Blumenthal asked Judge Kavanaugh exactly, but if they did, I did want to point out again, if they thought that Mueller or Hamilton was lying about one thing, then it seems really unlikely that they would have still found the appellant guilty. They could have just found him not guilty if they thought it was less than $2,500. And so there was no need for a lesser included instruction. Any of the errors with respect to the evidence or the jury argument, even if they were errors, they were not harmful on that basis. If there are no other questions, I'll...
Mr. Wood, would you mind taking 5 minutes extra and give us the total breakdown on the Kavanaugh hearings?
Well, I watched the whole thing, at least in the background.
You'll need more than 5 minutes.
I'll need more than five, but, you know, since we're all appellate lawyers here, we can talk about it later.
Sure. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you. And I certainly don't want to be recorded with my opinions on it.
I'm happy to share my opinions on the Kavanaugh hearing. But to wrap things up, we don't think it's speculative at all for a jury to take a look at the evidence, including the extent of the damage, and say, that's a pretty big hole in that wall. I'm still not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the amount of loss to the owner was in excess of $2,500, absent corroborating documentation showing what the owner actually paid to have it repaired. And again, just reviewing the record just now, it does appear that there was no documentation. There was just testimony, and it wasn't even direct testimony about specifically I was paid this amount from the insurance company, at least as I can find in the record. There was testimony about the insurance payout and that he was paid more than the $9,000 or whatever that he testified he spent. But again, nobody from the insurance company testified, and there was no documentation of any payout. It really, again, it boils down to the jury charge issue, that is, our argument about the lesser included offense. We don't want trial judges to take factual issues out of the hands of the jury. Anytime there's a rational factual dispute and the defense properly and timely requests a jury charge or a jury instruction on that issue, as the defense did in this case, then the judge should let the jury decide that. And if we were to accept the argument that, well, you know, if the jury, you know, if it was rational for the jury to doubt the $2,500 to $30,000 amount, then they would have found him not guilty. If we were to apply that argument in this case, then you could apply that argument to say, you know, denial of a lesser included instruction is never a reversible error as long as the jury convicts on the greater included. So again, it boils down to, at the very least, all we're arguing is that the defense was entitled to an instruction on the lesser included offense, and we're not speculating whether a jury would have convicted him or acquitted him on the greater count and convicted of the lesser. And I think the state graciously has conceded in its brief that if it was error, then appellant did suffer some harm. So we're not even here to argue about harm. The only thing I'll add, just on the business records issue, the trial judge's rationale adopted by the state in its brief that Mr. Hamilton had adopted these records as his own, and they were admissible as his own business records because he had marked on them. I could find no case. I researched that issue after I read the state's brief. I could find no case where any court in this state has adopted basically that rule as applied to the business records exception, saying that one business can adopt the records of another business as its own, and therefore they're admissible, or at least that the person who alters the records, the second person who comes along and adds to it, is a competent witness to testify to prove up the business records predicate. The adoptive admission rule, as we all know, applies to an exception to hearsay when something is a statement of a party opponent. So we disagree with the state and the trial court's reasoning in this case that was a basis for the admissibility of the business records. With that, unless there are any questions, we pray for reversal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We thank you for your argument today. Your case is now submitted, and you're free to leave.